From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Former FBI Director James Comey testified under oath today before the Senate Intelligence Committee, his first public statement since being fired by President Trump as director of the FBI on May 9th. Early on in his opening remarks, Comey addressed what happened after President Trump dismissed him.
And although the law required no reason at all to fire an FBI director, the administration then chose to defame me and, more importantly, the FBI by saying that the organization was in disarray, that it was poorly led, that the workforce had lost confidence in its leader. Those were lies, plain and simple.
When he was fired, Comey was heading up that investigation into Russia's possible role in the run-up to last year's presidential election. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis joins us. And Susan, that was not the only time Comey used the word lie. He later said that he documented his conversations with President Trump because of the seriousness of their conversations that they had, but also because he thought the president might lie about them. Were you surprised by that?
You know, I certainly think that those are the moments that the country is going to see repeated over and over from today's testimony, that the former FBI director had a fundamental distrust of President Trump. And certainly in comparison to the two previous presidents that he had served under, Presidents Obama and George W. Bush, that was really striking to hear. It is not necessarily surprising, considering the things that we have learned through essentially media leaks since the firing of Jim Comey, and that the conversation he had with the president where the president had asked him for loyalty and those sort of details. We knew that this was a very complicated relationship, but it's the first time we have heard Mr. Comey use the word lie. And when you hear that, particularly coming from a former FBI director about the president of the United States, it was a really striking moment in the testimony today.
Well, the big question going in was, did President Trump try to stop that Russia investigation or impede in any way? And Comey said, President Trump said he hoped Comey would drop the investigation into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. And then Comey was asked this by Senator Burr, the Republican chair of the committee.
In your estimation, was General Flynn at that time in serious legal jeopardy? And in addition to that, do you sense that the president was trying to obstruct justice or just seek for a way for Mike Flynn to save face, given he had already been fired?
Well, General Flynn at that point in time was in legal jeopardy. There was an open FBI criminal investigation of his statements in connection with the Russian contacts and the contacts themselves. And so that was my assessment at the time.
And Susan Comey went on to say he did feel it was his place to say whether obstruction of justice occurred. But from that exchange and others, is that going to be the takeaway? What is the takeaway?
Well, he is correct. It is not his role. And certainly as a former government employee, it is not his role and not the setting to suggest that the president has obstructed justice. It's an ongoing investigation. We don't know the answer to the question. But former FBI Director Robert Mueller is leading that special. He's the special counsel. He's leading that investigation. And by all accounts, both from Mr. Comey and I would say both Republicans and Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee, they have faith in that investigation.
Yeah. There was a pushback as well to James Comey, including from Marco Rubio. Mm-hmm. He seemed to downplay the conversations that Comey had. I mean, this was, as you said, a lot was coming out as Comey detailed these meetings, talked about being asked to be loyal to the president. And here's Senator Rubio seeming to downplay that.
The three requests were, number one, be loyal. Number two, let the Mike Flynn thing go. He's a good guy. He's been treated unfairly. And number three, can you please tell the American people what these leaders in Congress already know, what you already know, what you've told me three times, that I'm not under personally under investigation?
He seemed to detail pretty well there, but seemed to be saying, well, what do you think he was saying? You know, we've heard all this was one of the things you could hear from there.
Well, Senator Rubio made this point, as did many Republicans on the panel, and they have a point that Comey both testified and previously was known that the president was not under personal investigation, that it was a wide-ranging investigation into Russian meddling, but President Trump was not a target of that investigation prior to the election or afterwards. So I think that from the Republican viewpoint, there is a frustration that a lot of this is being a lot of the overlapping threads of the Russian investigation are tainting the president, even though he's not a direct target of the investigation, which is a point that Republicans time and time again again in this hearing sought to highlight again that this is that has not changed. But there are certainly affiliates of the Trump administration, Michael Flynn being one of them, that are part of this broader investigation.
Well, Paul Ryan, as the leader, spoke earlier this afternoon and addressed the conversations between Comey and Trump.
Of course, there needs to be a degree of independence between DOJ, FBI, and a White House, and a line of communications established. The president's new at this. He's new to government. And so he probably wasn't steeped in the long-running protocols that establish the relationships between DOJ, FBI, and White Houses. He's just new to this.
Susan, first of all, how damning do you think this testimony has been today? And is that going to be the Republican line of defense?
I'm not sure that damning is a word I would use. Mm-hmm. I think I would say it's been more revelatory and it's been more corroborative. It's that it's corroborated a lot of the things that we've seen reported in the media that were the sources were unclear. Today we found out that one of those sources was James Comey. He did also acknowledge in this hearing that he authorized the leak through a friend to the New York Times about his memos detailing those Trump dinners.
He said he did that when he heard the president make that sort of semi-threatening tweet about perhaps there will be tapes that he sat up and said to his friend, leak my memo. Yeah.
Right. And the broader takeaway today is that the Republicans in Congress and the Republican Party broadly are very much behind President Trump.
NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thank you.
You bet.
Well, the opioid epidemic has claimed more lives in Ohio than any other state. The attorney general there filed a lawsuit against five drug companies last week, accusing them of misleading doctors and patients about the dangers of opioids. But the problem goes well beyond the doctor's office, as more people are ordering drugs on the internet and having packages of fentanyl delivered to their doors. Nick Castell of Here Now contributor WCPN IdeaStream reports.
At the Lake County Crime Laboratory in Painesville, Ohio, analysts test drug samples from police searches and overdose scenes. The opiates come in all forms, in powder, in rocks, and in syringes. Forensic analyst Bill Kubek runs the substances through a machine called a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. He says it's like a big oven. It helps him determine what's in the samples.
If there's multiple things in that powder, say heroin and fentanyl, it'll separate those out.
These are potent drugs, and lab workers here take precautions against direct contact.
We wear gloves at all times when we're handling evidence. We wear masks. To make sure we don't breathe in anything, any powders that go up into the air.
The overdose antidote Narcan is kept on hand, just in case. The supervisor of chemistry and toxicology at the lab is Douglas Rohde. He recalls a time not long ago when he worked 20 days straight to keep up with the caseload.
Our numbers have just gone through the roof for drug submissions.
Heroin and the usual fentanyl aren't the only drugs coming through the lab anymore. Now, Rohde's lab and others across Ohio are detecting new alternative forms of fentanyl. Rohde says he cannot tell by examining a drug where it was made, but there's evidence at least some of the substances, he says, are coming in the mail from overseas.
We have had submissions here where the return label is Hong Kong, and we know that individuals are ordering the drugs directly from China.
I get a call probably two or three times a week from our postal folks saying, hey, we got another package. It's this synthetic drug this time. It's this derivative of fentanyl.
Joe Pinu is a prosecutor with the Northern District of Ohio U.S. Attorney's Office. A report from the Drug Enforcement Administration last year identified chemical labs in China as the primary source of fentanyl sent to North America. Some shipments go directly to the U.S. Some travel first to Mexico or Canada before being smuggled across the border. The amount of fentanyl processed in U.S. crime labs grew 65% from 2014 to 2015, according to the DEA. With authority to oversee customs and the border, Homeland Security investigators don't need a warrant to open international packages. Still, Pinu says tracking mailed fentanyl can be difficult.
You know, you would think it would be easy, right? It's in the mail. We kind of control the mail. We control the delivery of the mail. But it's so voluminous. If you think of just the normal packages that come to the United States on a daily basis from a country like China that's producing all the things that they produce, it's not easy.
This year, two Northeast Ohio men were charged in connection with fentanyl shipments from overseas. And an Akron man received a 20-year prison sentence after pleading guilty to charges that included fentanyl distribution. Prosecutors said he ordered it from China and sold a quantity that caused a fatal overdose. Steve Francis is the acting special agent in charge of Homeland Security investigations in Michigan and Ohio. He says the overseas deliveries are going to a wide range of people.
What we've seen thus far in Ohio is, you know, I mean, all the above. I think we've seen users, we've seen sellers, we've seen transnational criminal organizations that are ordering them.
According to DEA numbers, Ohio crime labs reported seeing more fentanyl than labs in any other state. It's a phenomenon that puzzles law enforcement, says Joe Pinu with the U.S. Attorney's Office.
That reasoning still escapes us. Like, why Ohio is number one? More fentanyl overdose deaths, more seizures, more of the synthetic stuff that's coming in across the mail. Like, really, Ohio, and especially Northeast Ohio, is really ground zero for the fentanyl problem right now.
Overdose deaths involving fentanyl surged last year in Cuyahoga County, home to Cleveland. The county medical examiner reports cases in which it's mixed with heroin or cocaine. Deaths in 2017 are projected to exceed last year's numbers. For Here and Now, I'm Nick Castell.
And you're listening to Here and Now. President Trump is calling this week Infrastructure Week. He's proposing a $1 trillion project to rebuild the country's roads and bridges, backed by $200 billion of federal money and hoping to leverage $800 billion of private financing.
The great highway system, the interstate highway system, we don't do that anymore. We really don't. We don't even fix the old highways anymore. We'll take even fixing them. But we're going to get them going again like they've never been before.
It's unclear if Trump can get the support he needs in Congress for such a big infrastructure bill. And he wouldn't be the first president to face such a challenge. For a look back at the history, we're joined by Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Good to be here, Jeremy.
And you would think that infrastructure, at least compared to some of the other issues in Washington, would be kind of a more bipartisan, safe consensus issue. But that's not what you found, is it?
No, not at all, Jeremy. It actually turns out to be one of the most contentious issues across American history, contentious on all kinds of fronts, whether the national government should do it or local government, and most of all, who should benefit from especially transportation projects, which really pick winners and losers depending on the route.
Well, what were some of the earliest projects that the government took on?
Well, probably the most uncontroversial big project that the government took on was lighthouses. I'll bet you didn't see that coming, right?
No, I didn't. I thought you were going to say something else.
Yeah. Well, lighthouses were really important to the intercoastal trade, which was one of the things that really knit the country together after the Constitution was signed. And it was not controversial because everybody benefited from a whole system of lighthouses. But it was also not controversial because the national government was very delicate in the way it put together the system. It basically bought existing state lighthouses, added a few of its own, and it was very careful to use local contractors and local architects so that it really didn't leave a big footprint.
And once they had their lighthouses, they got to their canals, and the Erie Canal was, what, 200 years ago this year?
That's a great example of a state-funded project, right? I mean, we had a relatively small national government. We had a growing state that wanted to develop economically in New York, and they subsidized and paid for the construction of a canal that stretched all the way from the Hudson River to Lake Erie, and it was crucial for promoting transportation and trade across New York, getting beyond the Appalachian Mountains in order to open up the West.
There were also a lot of questions about like what it would mean to have these projects that would allow the federal government to really, you know, flex its muscle at the local level. And by the time you get to the Erie Canal's kind of final expansion of the era around the turn of the century in 1903, you really then have a kind of fervor around the country, almost a hot and heavy moment in the progressive era where people are trying to figure out how to engage in a kind of mass technocratic response to any number of social or bodily ills. I mean, you have so much building that's done around the turn of the century and through the 1920s that has to do with, you know, again, adding massive water systems to city grids, swamp drainage projects, even, believe it or not, racial segregation as a kind of Jim Crow prophylactic really against social conflict was part of this progressive era moment. And people are using publicly funded roads and green spaces to erect the infrastructure of segregation literally between people of different racial groups.
And was there the kind of pushback on some of those projects at that time that we see now? Were there people who said, we can't afford it?
Absolutely. I mean, it all depends, of course, on who's benefiting and who can do what with what. I think it's really important to point out things like, you know, germs and public health crises that can break out. The wealthy and the poor are equally, you know, susceptible. So a good water grid is really important. But you look at a figure like Robert Moses, for instance, the kind of great, or some might say infamous, master builder of New York City. He learned during this period in the early 20th century how to take advantage of local monies and state monies to basically, again, pick winners and losers in terms of infrastructure projects. And he was very effective at using those early lessons about how to combine different pots of money to then, of course, bring us into a much heavier moment of building that became the 1930s and then later the post-war period.
Well, and that period, even if you drive around today, you see markers that say that this was built under the Works Progress Administration, that this came from that very big building period under Franklin Roosevelt. They did all kinds of things, dams, bridges, rural electrification.
That's absolutely right. And of course, you're talking about a period of the greatest economic crisis in American history. And there was pretty broad acceptance that the government had some role to play in terms of getting the economy going. And one of the best, and many people argue the most cost-effective way of getting the economy going again, was putting the people to work, building things of lasting value.
How come we don't do that anymore?
Well, I mean, I think we do build things, but, you know, I think it's also really important to go back to the so-called good old days of 1950s and 60s era big projects like, say, the interstate highway system, right? I mean, you look at the interstate highway that was developed in the mid-1950s, 1956, the Highway Act comes into place, and it really does define the next 10 years of massive construction. It's really important to acknowledge the benefits of this moment. I mean, the American interstate highway system is by far the largest project ever constructed by humankind. Far dwarfs the Great Wall of China, the pyramids. You can see it from space. I mean, it is a massive project. But again, you know, the costs that are borne through a project that was effectively meant to solve evacuation problems or military troop movement problems during the Cold War was also used as an instrument at the local level to basically determine who was going to be allowed to live where, how you were going to have kind of urban growth, if you were going to, in fact, grow the middle class at all. It had to largely be on the backs of these kinds of projects. And a lesser known piece of this story, Jeremy, is the fact that many cities saw in the federal highway system almost a golden goose, right? The federal government was willing to spend cover nine tenths of the cost of what would basically be used to condemn properties, to displace properties. And so the definition of what, you know, some conservative observers might call pork barrel spending was really, you know, evident in the fact that the federal government could cover 90% of the costs that so many local officials wanted to incur to make sure that they were displacing populations or redrawing the boundaries of kind of prosperity and wealth in their own cities.
Jeremy, I have a more boring answer for you, which is a lot of the basic infrastructure that we need to communicate and get around is there. What it desperately needs is upgrading and repair.
Right. Right.
And that stuff is really boring and really hard to sell politically. I mean, imagine, do you want your dad to come home with a holiday gift that's a new basketball court and a new basket? Or do you want him to come home and say, son, I have a new net for you for your old hoop?
I fixed your toys from last year. Here
exactly.
They are.
They'll look all shiny when I'm done.
Well, and since you mentioned the interstate highway system, we have to take advantage of the fact that because we're talking to you, you're historians, and oftentimes you're talking about stuff that happened before there was tape. In this case, we have tape, and this is from the 50s. It's Walter Cronkite doing the voiceover for a promotional film for the Caterpillar Tractor Company.
We're going to get a brand new system of highways, roads, and streets in this country. We're going to transform our old, battered, outmoded, and overloaded interstate roads into superhighways that meet the standards and needs of 1975. From the farms to the heart of our cities, we're going to rebuild, improve, replace.
Okay, so let's flash forward to today, and I don't know if we're going to get an ad like that from one of the news anchors right now, but you know, when people compare what the United States does now with infrastructure to other countries, they often point to China and say, look how quickly China can build, you know, a railroad or a highway. But then again, in a country like China, they can say, we're knocking down all these houses and that's what's happening. Has it become just much more difficult for the U.S. to build over time because of legal hurdles along the way? People suing, saying, I don't want you to build that highway right next to my house.
I think it has become more difficult, but it's become more difficult for the best of reasons, Jeremy. It's become more difficult because a far broader range of citizens have a say in the process that'll be used in construction. And I think that's what we call democracy. Look, one of the reasons that that golden age of public works that Nathan was referring to was golden is we had bosses. We had city machines, and actually they made a tidy profit on a lot of these huge projects. I think what we have today, at least as far as democratic values are concerned, is better.
I'm a little bit less optimistic than my colleague.
He always is.
There's also something to say about the fact that many people are much more resistive to the kinds of big projects that we used to build, right? I mean, there was certainly a sense of kind of national civic pride around building an airport system or, again, the interstate highways. And one of the things that you're seeing now, I think, is an interesting return to a kind of federalist ethos. I mean, there was an amazing exchange last week between Mike Mulvaney, the budget director for the president, and Senator from Michigan, Debbie Stabenow. And it was about $30 million that used to be allocated toward water preservation efforts in the Great Lakes region. And Mulvaney's argument was that people from Arkansas should not be expected to pay for water treatment projects in the Great Lakes area. And Stabenow's response, which is great, is that basically, look, the Great Lakes area has 20% of the world's fresh water. And having a country, and that's a quote, means being willing to be from Arkansas and to cover the kinds of costs that would be necessary to benefit everyone and preserve a kind of national and really global treasure that the Great Lakes water supply represents. And so bringing back some sense of national buy-in is also going to be necessary, I think, before you start talking about any larger kinds of projects.
Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much as always.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you're listening to Here and Now. Today, the House of Representatives is expected to pass the Financial Choice Act. Speaker Paul Ryan has called it the crown jewel of the Republican Party's regulatory reforms. But critics say it would gut the 2010 Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, also known as Dodd-Frank. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She's with us from New York. Hi, Lynette.
Hi, how are you guys?
Doing well. And it seems like one of the major features of this bill is that it would gut the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Is that right?
That's true. And that's the bureau that kind of keeps track of predatory lending, credit card rates, has a reporting mechanism for people who feel like they've been mistreated by banks, and kind of monitors the system on behalf of consumers.
What else would the bill do?
Well, it does quite a lot. I mean, it does everything from, you know, removing a rule that stops oil and gas companies in foreign countries from being opaque to it removes what we call the orderly liquidation scenario. And that's really important. When Lehman fell, that bankruptcy is still ongoing. It's because we had no mechanism for organizing, okay, this is how we deal with this bank problem. The order liquidation scenario is, okay, these are the steps that we take when a bank is going under. Ideologically, a lot of the Tea Parties and right-wing Republicans oppose this because they say it's a handout to banks. But reality, it's a handout to American taxpayers who don't have to deal with the chaos of a bankruptcy that lasts forever and ever and ever.
Well, and the big question here is after the financial crisis, this law was put into place because people thought that it would make the country safer from another crisis like that. If you start taking away some of these major aspects of Dodd-Frank, does it put us at risk of another financial crisis?
Look, I mean, that's the word is risk, right? One part of the Dodd-Frank that will be removed is the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule is what stops banks from proprietary trading, trading their own books. And going back to Lehman was over-levered. It was trading its own house and had a ton of bad trades on its books. So many bad trades that it was just insolvent. And so banks can't do that anymore. Immediately after the financial crisis, we saw that big Wall Street banks were taking a big hit for that quarter after quarter. And all those talented traders left to another part of Wall Street. So the banks were advocating for that. What they were not advocating, and I should probably make this clear, they were not advocating for the end of the orderly liquidation scenario. That's a politically ideological thing that comes from the Tea Party and the chair of the House Finance Committee, Jeb Hensarling from Texas.
How is this bill likely to fare in the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, but a smaller margin, if indeed it passes the Republican House?
It will pass the House down the line. And we should also note that, by the way, Hensarling accepted over $500,000 from the banks and other Wall Street firms in 2016. But the Senate, not so much. They will look at this bill. They're more conservative. It's probably DOA there, but it's still unclear.
That's Lynette Lopez, senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Lynette, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
A recent report from the Urban Institute comes to a pretty shocking conclusion. States with more black residents have less generous welfare benefits. Vermont, for instance, about 1% black, gives TANF, or temporary assistance for needy families, to 78 out of every 100 poor families. Arkansas, about 15% black, gives TANF benefits to just 7 out of every 100 poor families. Oregon, like Vermont, about 1% black, gives a single-parent family of three in poverty $506 a month. Mississippi, 60% black, gives under half of that, $170 per month. The study concludes if the poor look like the people pulling the purse strings, traditionally largely white state officials, they will get benefits. If they don't, they won't. Heather Hahn is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and one of the authors of the study. And Heather, I know you have some conclusions that are outside the question of race, but have I largely got your conclusion right when it comes to race?
Yes. So we found that state policy decisions on TANF are significantly related to race. States with large African-American populations, all else equal, have less generous and more restrictive TANF policies.
You say all things being equal, but are they? You know, is it possible that a state that gives out more money per poor family has fewer families in poverty? And since these are, you know, finite block grants from the federal government, is it possible poorer states have more demand for the benefit and so to meet that demand have to give fewer benefits?
Well, one of the factors that we looked at was the child poverty rate in the state. And we looked to see if the child poverty rate was associated with different policy choices. We also looked at whether the share of the state legislature that was Democratic or Republican had an effect on the different policy choices. And those variables had some effect on some individual policies. But when we looked across the board at the policies, the consistent pattern was that the share of the African-American population was what was associated with the less generous and more restrictive TANF policies. And that's holding constant the child poverty rate and the political factors and other demographic and economic factors in the state.
And there are other differences as well in states with a larger African-American population seeking help. There are often more restrictions.
Yes. So if we take a specific example of the consequences for a family that does not comply with the work requirements, for example, most states, if a recipient does not comply with the work requirements, there are what are called sanctions or consequences. And often that starts with a benefit reduction that then escalates to the closing of the case or termination of all benefits if that noncompliance continues. There are some states where the first time someone does not comply with work requirements, the initial sanction is to close the case or terminate all benefits. And what we found was that if you look at the average state, this isn't any actual state, but a state that had all the average characteristics of the nation, there was a 44% likelihood that that state would have this harsh initial sanction where all the benefits are cut off the first time someone does not comply with the work requirements. If you took a state that was the same in every respect, except that the African-American share of the state population was 5 percentage points higher than average, then instead of a 44% likelihood of having that harsh initial sanction, there'd be a 54% likelihood of having that harsh initial sanction. So that's just one concrete example of how that plays out.
Well, there's other examples of differences. Oregon, again, a state with a largely white population, helps people get off welfare, tries to get them a job, pays their wages for up to 6 months when they're off welfare. Mississippi, which has a work requirement, doesn't help them get a job. So there's sort of a divide here. And 'twas always thus. We're reading a terrific piece in The Atlantic about the history of this kind of assistance. And originally it was called mother's pensions. This was the precursor to welfare, early 1900s. They mostly went to white women, widows. And in fact, caseworkers at the time denied these benefits to African-American women because they felt African-Americans should be working, and that was beneath these white widows. I mean, this is well documented.
Yes, there is a long history of racial differences in social welfare in this country. Providing welfare was a local responsibility and very subjective. And so to a large degree, welfare was available only to white widows or others who were deemed deserving or morally upright. And over time, and then especially in the 1960s, the federal government gained an increasing role in providing welfare. And with that, established objective eligibility rules that opened access to African-American families in poverty.
Yeah, but even then, it's just so fascinating. Then President Johnson, launching this war on poverty, knew that he had to go and have a picture taken with a white family, a poor white family, to launch the PR campaign, because he knew that if he did it with a poor black family, he wouldn't get traction in Congress.
That's right. So what happened is, under these objective rules, more African Americans sought and received assistance, and so they were a larger part of the welfare caseload. And that contributed to a backlash that contributed to the welfare reforms of the 1990s that gave the policy control back to the states.
Yeah, this is under the Clinton administration. So we see the control going back to the states, and you seem to be tracking that kind of, I don't know what you'd call, I mean, it feels like prejudice, plays out in how benefits are handed out.
Right. So there is a stereotype that the typical welfare recipient is African American. And that's not true. In fact, about one-third of people receiving TANF cash assistance are African American. But that misperception influences how people think about who is poor and why, and shapes their thoughts about the policies that should address poverty. So those policies in some places are influenced by people's racial attitudes.
We should say there are more African Americans seeking welfare benefits relative to their number in the population.
That's right. So African Americans are disproportionately represented among welfare recipients, just as they are disproportionately represented among people living in poverty. But they are not the majority of cash assistance recipients.
Well, but this is such a vicious cycle, because that could be, that truth could be, more African Americans seeking benefits could be because they get stuck in this cycle, as opposed to the white poor who, as I mentioned, are helped out of poverty in many states.
Right. It's important to recognize, though, that the state policies themselves are race neutral. So within a state, the state policies apply to everybody equally. But what we see is that the effects of the policies are not equal.
Right. Congress is now considering block grants for other kinds of benefits. As you do this research, what's your thinking?
TANF is a cautionary tale about what block grants can mean. So based on what I see in TANF, I would predict that if we were to block grant other programs, we would see similar results, in that fewer families would receive assistance. And when we look across the nation, we would see racial disparities in the provision of that assistance.
And they're considering block grants for things like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. These are food stamps, largely for children and others. Heather Hahn, I know you had other discoveries in the Urban Institute research, a comparison between Texas and California, for instance, that doesn't have as much to do with race.
Right. So states have different philosophies and cultures about supporting low-income families, and those may or may not be connected to race at all. And so Texas, for example, is a state that I call a pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps state, where they expect people to support themselves. And it's a place where only four families received TANF cash assistance for every 100 families living in poverty recently. California is a contrast, where the state has made a commitment to serving vulnerable families, especially vulnerable children. And in California, 65 families receive TANF assistance for every 100 in poverty. So it's hard to quantify or or measure those philosophies, but when states have the flexibility to set policies as they do under block grants, state philosophies will prevail in determining what those policies are.
And this underscores what we said at the very beginning. It has nothing to do with, you know, one state maybe having more demand for welfare benefits than another, because Texas and California are pretty much, you know, big states.
Yes, with high poverty rates.
Yeah. Heather Hahn, senior fellow at the Urban Institute and co-author of the new study, Why Does Cash Welfare Depend on Where You Live? Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, your thoughts. Are you surprised to hear that only 30% of recipients of TANF benefits are Black? States with more white recipients have more generous benefits. We'd love your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
The Atlantic hurricane season has officially started, and meteorologists predict it will be more active than usual. But in Savannah, Georgia, crews are still cleaning up from last fall's Hurricane Matthew, including in cemeteries and historic sites where the damage can extend underground when trees are uprooted. Emily Jones of Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting went along with a crew looking for unearthed history in a Savannah cemetery.
It's a sunny weekend morning in Laurel Grove South, a historically African-American cemetery on the west side of Savannah. It's hard to imagine a cloud in the sky or a drop of rain, but in October 2016, Hurricane Matthew left its mark here. Near the entrance, where a lush stand of laurel oak trees once stood, is a line of crooked stumps with their roots heaved partway out of the ground. A tree removal team is standing by to saw up the stumps, but first...
I'm going to screen that root ball over there since he lifted it up for me.
Rob Lundeen shovels dirt from the ball of roots under each stump into a wooden frame with a fine grate for a bottom. He's an archaeologist hired by the city to search for historic artifacts.
A lot of times you can hear the artifacts inside the screen when you're shaking it, depending on what it is. And you can hear that clamshell in there. Sort of snapping against the wall here.
It's actually an oyster shell, and those are everywhere in Savannah, so there's no need to save it. Lundeen doesn't find anything important in these roots, so he gives the okay to the tree service to crank up the grinder. All this makes for slow going, but money for disaster cleanup comes from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the law requires the agency to consider the possible impact on historic properties and artifacts. In a historic cemetery like this one, archaeologists could find human remains among the tree roots. But archaeologist Brent Handley says his team is looking for more than just the people buried here.
Hardware is almost as important as the human remains, because during this time, a lot of these older cemeteries fall within a period of what we refer to as the beautification of death. And a lot of caskets and crypts and everything were very ornate.
The beautification trend is evident in Laurel Grove South, which was founded in 1853 for Savannah's African-American community. Some graves feature tall stone obelisks or headstones carved like a scroll of parchment. The city's director of cemeteries, Richard Gerbasi, says all of this tells a story.
It tells a story of a culture. It tells a story of the city. Anywhere from the items used to mark a grave to the inscriptions that they put on their monuments.
This cemetery is still in use, and during the 19th and 20th centuries was the area's most significant final resting place for African Americans. While slavery was still legal, more free Blacks were interred here than any other cemetery in the Southeast. The trouble is, Hurricane Matthew jumbled some of that story, and it could be difficult to piece back together.
And unfortunately, the records aren't as accurate as we'd like. So, you know, you have to be very careful because there's no telling what you can find.
In one place, a felled sweet gum tree knocked over several large pieces of stone as its roots tore out of the ground. The stump, more than 5 feet across, sits atop an obelisk. The crew has to move the stone to the side to grind down the massive stump. Once it's gone, Lundeen, the other archaeologist, tries to piece the site back together with Rich Nugent from the tree service.
See, those were sitting on this side of the tree coming out of the ground, as you can see in the photograph. That one was pointed out that way.
I bet you
the ones with the arches would go here,
right,
here, and then the straight piece on the top.
Yeah.
It's a jigsaw puzzle.
They arrange the pieces as best they can so the area looks like the surrounding grave sites. But it will be a bigger project to get everything back where it belongs. Going forward, Gerbasi says he hopes to document all the sites with photos or digital coordinates so there's a better record the next time a storm comes. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Jones in Savannah, Georgia.